now are permanently dry. Snake's Water is a case in point, as are Dilubituit, Bird's Water, another dry spring, and Tunutuit, Foul Water, a former seep, probably sulfurous, located far to the west. Other localities, according to their names, once gave life to species of plants that thrive under moist conditions, and these plants have either vanished or persist in stunted form. Tuoka Cicadae, stand of arrow cane, where today no cane exists, offers a telling example. So does Tuis Cicadae, grove of cottonwood trees, where one small tree remains. And these are only a few. Judging from what happened at these and other places, Charles goes on to say, there can be no doubt that the country was wetter and greener when the ancestors first explored it. This was one of the reasons, if not the major reason, they found it to their liking and decided to make it their home. For they were farmers as well as hunters. They had corn they wanted to plant, and they searched everywhere for water and its telltale signs. In this, they were not disappointed, as their place names plainly reveal. The names do not lie, Charles states emphatically. They show what is different and what is still the same. Like so many faithful photographs, he says, they record the look of the land as it was in ancestral times, and the look of the land was lush. It is less so today. Something must have happened. Water, obviously, began to go away. After lighting a cigarette and pouring a cup of coffee from the thermos we carry with us, Charles volunteers that no one really knows. He implies with a shrug that no one really cares when the water began to go away. It was sometime in the past, he says, and whether it happened slowly or fast, the people would have noticed and would have been concerned. There was water enough for life to go on. The streams still flowed, and rains still came in the summer and fall, but it was definitely less abundant, and its sources were less predictable. And this would have been interpreted as a punitive response wrought by water itself to something the people had done. There had to be a reason for what was taking place, and the one most likely adduced, because it was the simplest and farthest reaching, was that water had been offended by acts of disrespect. Charles has wondered often what kinds of acts these were. Maybe, he says, the people were greedy, taking from springs and streams more water than they needed. Maybe they were wasteful, throwing water away they should have been careful to save. Or maybe they ceased doing everything correctly, neglecting in haste or forgetfulness, to give repeated thanks to water for giving of itself. No one knows for sure, Charles says again, but no one doubts that the people were greatly alarmed to learn that they were at fault. He then travels back in his mind to the place from which we have come, imagining there the difficult day when a group of his ancestors, thirsty and eager to drink, discovered to their dismay that the spring at Snake's Water was dry. The people came again to get water and saw that there was none. They were expecting it to be there. They were shocked. The women began to wail. The men stood silent and still. Why has Snake's Water dried up? Why has this happened? What have we done to cause this to happen? Water must surely be angry at us. This is what they are thinking. Now they are walking away, thirsty and shaking with fear. The women are wailing, louder and louder. Their children are crying too. They are wailing as if a relative had died. What if this happens elsewhere? What if this happens everywhere? What if water takes all of itself away? They are deeply frightened, because of what they have done. Our holy people must work on this for us. This is what they are saying as they walk away from Snake's Water. Our holy people must help us by making amends to water. They must help us so we may live. They must ask water to take pity on us. What if this happened everywhere? This is what they are thinking. This is what they are praying. They do not understand. They are terribly afraid. The women are wailing louder, as if a relative has died. Already they have started to pray. Charles stands up and drinks the last of his coffee. The day is done. We return to the Jeep. On the drive back to Cibecue, no one says a word. Juniper Tree stands alone. All ethnographers occasionally lose their snap, and so, of course, do those with whom they work. Rarely does the problem reach epic proportions, but it can happen. On a Saturday late in June, with nothing more in store than a quiet weekend in Cibecue, I was stung twice on the nose by hornets, broke my last pair of eyeglasses, and got bitten on the hand by an aggravated centipede while playing Aggravation, a locally popular board game with three Apache enthusiasts. I also managed to run out of gas, which in Cibecue is taken as evidence of dangerously low intelligence. During the same 8-hour period, Morley received a very unfortunate haircut, tore his pants on a barbed wire gate, and bought beer from a lady from out of town who responded to his kindness by trying to lift his wallet. He later sat down on a monstrous wad of bubblegum belonging to his 6-year-old niece, who flew into a rage and attacked him with a dustpan. For his part, Charles woke up with a nasty stomach flu, sliced his hand on a can of Spam, and failed to amuse his wife when he wrapped the wound in one of her favorite dish towels. He later misplaced his pocket knife, a fairly worrisome loss, only to discover it in the pocket of his jacket. Taken altogether, as more and more people rushed to observe, it was little short of hilarious, and when evening finally came, with Morley nursing a tender ego and me a bulbous nose, we went to call on Charles to see how he was doing. Charles seemed happy to see us, proclaiming as we entered his house that everyone has uneven days, one might as well expect them, and that next to pails of Crisco and double-bladed axes, his wife, he supposes, would strongly favor dish towels. The white man's best invention may be Pepto-Bismol. He chuckles at the thought. Ensconced on a couch with his nephew Jason, he inquires whether I am pleased with the work we have done so far. When I tell him I am, he replies that more lies ahead because places and their names are important to Apache people in many different ways. Jason here, who has just turned 11, is learning this already, and once we resume our trip into the country, Jason, by the way, will be joining us when we do. He and I can learn together. Soon, perhaps, we will take up the matter of Apache social lines, those close-knit groups of kin known to outsiders as clans, whose names for themselves are really the names of places. Charles, then, changes the subject by beaming a smile at Morley. "I know my wife can't hear me," he says, loudly in Apache, knowing that Mrs. Henry, who is close by in the kitchen, will pick up every word. "Speak to me, cousin, and don't leave anything out. What's this I hear about a beautiful widow from White River who made you tear your pants?" 3 days later, with Jason Henry in tow, and the rest of us feeling revived, we are back upon the land. Rain has fallen the night before, steady and hard for more than an hour, and the colors of the countryside, no longer dull beneath layers of dust, look clean and freshly restored. The air smells sharp and fragrant. It is cool for the first time in weeks. The sky is a robust blue. On the northern outskirts of Sibiku, we stop near a place named Gad o Aha. Juniper tree stands alone. A large flat encompassing four Apache homes, two horse corrals, and at least a dozen acres planted in corn and beans. With coffee cup in hand, Charles surveys the scene, which could hardly be more peaceful. The morning light is soft and full, and the tilled red earth, darkened by the rain to a deep maroon, provides a striking backdrop to the bright green rows of maize. A dog barks. A door slams. A young sorrel mare rolls in some mud to keep away the flies. The land is fairly glowing in calm and radiant gratitude for the blessings brought by rain. I cannot see a juniper tree, standing alone or otherwise, anywhere on the flat of juniper tree stands alone. A small but notable absence, which prompts me to think that Charles may speak again about how the country has changed since his ancestors took it over. He does not. Reaching out his hand to the fields of growing corn, he performs a scooping motion that seems to gather them up, drawing them together as though cradled in his palm and setting the stage for a place world about farming and the origin of clans. They had wandered all over this country, looking at everything, searching for good places to live. They searched for places that would protect them from enemy people. The Navajo were one. So they made their homes high on the sides of valleys, nestled among the rocks. They also searched for places where they could plant their corn. They looked for these near streams or where there was runoff from rain. By now they knew the country well. They had given names to many places, like this one, Juniper Tree Stands Alone, and they thought they would survive and raise their families here. This country is where they would live and raise their children. Now they are settling at different places. Some of them settled here, not right here on the flat. It would have exposed them to enemy people, but fairly close by, somewhere higher up, somewhere well concealed. This was long ago. Now they are planting their corn here, not far from the stream, here on the flat. Corn grows plentifully here, they are saying. We have enough to eat and also to store away. They are grateful to corn and to this place for helping them survive. They prayed often. Their prayers were strong. They did everything correctly. They were happy and grew confident. They didn't stay here all the time. Some would make journeys to hunt for deer. Some would make journeys to dig and roast agave. Some would go off to collect seeds and cactus fruits. Some would go off for salt. But they would always return here, in plenty of time, to harvest their corn. They would roast and dry it. They saved its seeds to plant again. They kept dried corn to eat in winter and early spring, when they knew they would be hungry. Now, long ago, those people who planted corn at Juniper Tree Stands Alone are coming back to harvest it. They have been off looking for acorns, but have gathered only a few. Two or three older people have been left behind to watch over the corn. They are coming nearer now, the ones who have been away, praying and singing as they approach. They are praying that nothing has happened to injure or harm their corn. What will we do if there is no corn, they are thinking. But they are reluctant to say this out loud. Now they can see their cornfields. There is much corn. There is corn in abundance. They are excited and happy. They know they will not go hungry. They know their prayers have been strong. Juniper Tree Stands Alone has looked after us again. Later, after getting their homes in order again, their leaders are talking. This is where our women first planted corn. They have planted it again and again. Each year we have harvested enough to roast and dry and store away. These fields look after us by helping our corn to grow. Our children eat it and become strong. We eat it and continue to live. Our corn draws life from this earth, and we draw life from our corn. This earth is part of us. We are of this place. Juniper tree stands alone. We should name ourselves for this place. We are God O'an. Juniper tree stands alone, people. This is how it shall be. Now the people spoke among themselves and agreed with what their leaders had said. They agreed to be known for the place where they first planted corn. Now they spoke of themselves to other people that way. We are Juniper Tree Stands Alone people, they would say to them. This would happen elsewhere, at many different places throughout the country. Groups of people named themselves for the places where their women first planted corn. That is why our lines, clans, go through women. That is why we belong to the line of our mother. We are of our mother's line and for the line of our father. It has always been that way. You see, their names for themselves are really the names of their places. That is how they were known, to others and to themselves. They were known by their places. That is how they are still known, even though they have scattered and live now in many different states, some in cities far from here. Many of the old cornfields are no longer planted. The people have forgotten about them. They say it's too much work to plant them as before. But some, like those Juniper Tree Stands Alone people, have not forgotten. They still plant their corn in the same place, as they have always done. Their corn still makes their children strong. This place still looks after them. It shows them where their ancestors returned year after year to harvest their corn and store it away for the winter. As Charles is speaking, a woman who lives at Juniper Tree Stands Alone walks from her house to the edge of one of the cornfields, carrying over her arm an empty burlap sack and a folded canvas ground cloth. She is wearing a capacious blouse and a flowing full-length skirt, both a shade of brilliant pink, and her loosely braided hair is generously streaked with gray. Her name is Ellen Jose Tese. She is the leader of her clan, the oldest member and primary spokesperson of the Juniper Tree Stands Alone people. Charles watches in silence as she enters the cornfield, seats herself on her ground cloth, and begins to pull up weeds, placing them one by one inside the burlap sack. He then resumes his account, treating what he sees as a model of the past and transforming the figure of Ellen Tese, carefully tending her corn, into a fully present symbol of what happened long ago. The women looked after their corn. They looked after it well. The older people who stayed behind did this. They would go to their fields in the morning and stay there most of the day. Now they are clearing the fields of unwanted plants, putting them in something to later take them away. I am looking after you, just as I would my children, they are saying. Because of this, you will grow strong and tall and give us much to eat. I am praying this will happen. They were careful to do everything correctly. They didn't rush or try to hurry their work. They depended on their corn, so they treated it with respect. This would help it grow. They did everything correctly. When Charles is done, Morley remarks that he owes $2 to Ellen Tese's husband, which he might as well give to her now. We follow Morley along a path to the cornfield where she is working, she greets our approach with a genial smile, inquiring of no one in particular, "What brings you here?" Morley explains the reason for our presence and goes on to settle his debt. He then delivers a compliment on the vigor of her corn. "It seems to be growing well," she modestly replies. "Last night's rain will help it even more." Moments later, she addresses Jason Henry, who is standing half-hidden behind his grandfather. "Young one, do you know what I am doing?" Caught off guard by the directness of her question, Jason stares hard at the ground. "You are helping your corn," he responds in a faltering voice. Ellen Jose Tese smiles again. "Yes," she says gently. "I'm looking after my children." Shades of Shit. It is now mid-July, and our topographic maps of the Sibiku region are getting increasingly crowded. Dozens of dots and shaded areas mark the locations of places bearing Apache names, and numbers next to these index the names themselves, which are listed in separate notebooks. Morley says admiringly that some of the maps look like they were blasted with a shotgun, and more than once. Charles, modulated as always, expresses his approval in less effusive ways. Jason, who studies the maps whenever he gets a chance, has yet to voice an opinion. "I am struck by the mounting number of named localities. We have charted 109 in only 5 weeks, and the consistent manner in which they cluster, mainly around sources of water and past and present farm sites. But what impresses me most of all is the rich descriptive imagery of Western Apache place names. Lately, with ear and eye jointly enthralled, I have stood before Tse Dotish Te Na Hijaha. Green rocks side by side jut down into water, a group of mossy boulders on the bank of a stream. Tse Ditlige Na Ditine. Trail extends across scorched rocks, a crossing at the bottom of a canyon. Tis Tisose Bil Nagoga Iye. Circular clearing with slender cottonwood trees. A meadow. Tuji Ya Higaye. Whiteness spreads out descending to water. A sandstone cliff next to a spring. Tse Yadit Ishe. Line of blue below rocks. A mineral deposit. Ya Hubige. Stunted rising up. A small mountain. Kaubaye. Bil Na Gozwode. Gray willows curve around a bend, a point on a stream, and a number of other places whose handsomely crafted names, bold, visual, evocative, lend poetic force to the voices of the ancestors. Just as expressive are other Apache place names, different from these, that do not give close descriptions of the places to which they refer. Commemorative in character and linked to traditional stories, they allude instead to historical events that illuminate the causes and consequences of wrongful social conduct, and in this important capacity, as I would discover at a place named Shades of Shit, Cha Bidat Ohe, they invest the Apache landscape with a sobering moral dimension, dark but instructive, that placemakers can exploit to deeply telling effect. The shades, or brush-covered ramadas, are no longer standing. They collapsed, Charles says, a long time ago. Yet the place where they stood, a tree-covered knoll southwest of Sibiku, is avoided to this day. "No one wants to come here," he explains, as we slowly approach a vantage point 100 yards away. The people who lived here had farms down below, probably next to the creek. This was long after they settled in this valley. Then they did something bad, very bad, and they came close to dying. There is a story about it I was told by my grandfather. It's short. And it is... It happened here at Shades of Shit. They had much corn, those people who lived here, and their relatives had only a little. They refused to share it. Their relatives begged them, but still they refused to share it. Then, their relatives got angry and forced them to stay at home. They wouldn't let them go anywhere, not even to defecate, so they had to do it at home. Their shades filled up with it. There was more and more of it. It was very bad. Those people got sick and nearly died. Then, their relatives said, "You have brought this on yourselves. Now you live in shades of shit." Finally, they agreed to share their corn. It happened at Shades of Shit. An uneasy silence settles over our group. Jason looks suddenly wan. Morley spits in disgust. A soft breeze, recalling a terrible stench it could not possibly carry, ruffles the morning air. When Charles speaks again, he says that he wonders what really happened here. It couldn't have been as simple as the story suggests, and even if it were, he adds, the story gives no sense of why events unfolded as they did, or how the people involved might have reacted to them. What were they thinking? He asks rhetorically, in a tone of disbelief. How must they have felt? Charles would like to know these things, he says, though he doubts he ever will. And then, speaking as if he knew them very well, he tells his grandfather's story again, fleshing it out at length, and constructing for us an astonishing world, as surely revealing of Apache social values as it is violently offensive to their most basic sensibilities. It must have been late in the summer. Those people had harvested their corn and were drying it and roasting it. They must have been grateful and happy. "Now we have much to eat," they are saying. Their relatives envied them. Their own corn had not grown well. Sometimes it happens that way. Some fields produce a lot, and those right next to them do not. It happens that way, and no one knows why, and sometimes they talk of witchcraft prompted by revenge for something that was done to them in the past. Their own corn was meager and small, but they were not yet afraid or angry. "Our more fortunate relatives will help us," they said, speaking among themselves. "They have more than enough corn. They will want to share it with us. We have always helped each other. That is how it should be." Then they waited for their relatives to help them. They waited in vain. Their relatives kept their corn to themselves, eating it every day and making big shits when they went off into the brush. They did nothing for their relatives, although they noticed their plight. They have enough food, even though they harvested little corn. They probably have plenty of beans and squash. Some of them are skilled hunters. Soon they will have plenty of deer meat to eat. We will keep our corn for ourselves so that our children will not be hungry during the winter. Now, their poor relatives are becoming scared and puzzled. "Why do they not offer to help us?" they said. "They're treating us like we don't exist, as if we are nothing to them. We will have a hard time unless they change their minds and give us some of their corn." Then they sent someone to talk to the people who lived here. "We are your relatives," he said to them. "We must help each other. You have plenty of corn. We have seen it. But we have only a little, and soon it will be gone. Soon our children will be crying because they have nothing to eat. Give us some of your corn. Give us some of your corn. We will be grateful. This is how it should be." Then they waited again, and still their relatives did nothing for them. They talked again among themselves. "Our relatives are not going to help us," they said. "They have become greedy and stingy. They think only of themselves. They have put themselves above us, ignoring us like we don't exist. We have waited long enough. We must do something. Then they became angry at their own relatives. We will make them stay at their homes. They will not go anywhere. We will make them live with their own big shits. This is what they decided to do. Then they came over here and surrounded their relatives' homes. They told them to stay there. They did this day and night. We will harm you if you try to leave, they said. You have brought this on yourselves. You can eat all you want, only now you will shit at your homes. This is not how it should be, but we are doing it anyway, they said. Then those people must have thought they were joking. They don't really mean what they say, they said. They will not harm us, they said. So they chose a man to leave his home. He was forced back by his relatives. Another man tried to leave. He was also forced back. They mean what they say, they said. Now we are in for trouble, they thought. Then they started to shit in their shades. Some of them said, This is very bad. We should share our corn and put an end to it. Others said, No, if we give away some of our corn, they will want it all. We must not give in to them. This is their way of leaving us with nothing. Then they ate less and less, but still they fouled their shades. There was more and more of it. It was visible everywhere. The sight and smell could not be avoided. There were swarms and swarms of flies, huge swarms. They no longer cooked in their shades. Eating became something they detested. It was terrible. Then they started to get sick from the sight and smell of their own filth. Some of them were constantly dizzy. Others had trouble walking straight. Their children started moaning. They themselves were moaning. We could die from this, they said. We could die from our own filth. Then a man of the people, who had little corn, went and talked to them. You have brought this on yourselves, he said. You should have shared your corn with us as soon as you knew you had more than enough. You didn't do this. You gave us nothing at all. You were greedy and stingy, thinking only of yourselves. Because of this, we had to beg you to share your corn with us. Even then you did nothing. You just kept on eating more and more, knowing that we had little food of our own. You ignored us, your own relatives, as if we were nothing. This is not how it should be. As relatives, we make each other rich because we help each other in times of need. It has been this way since the beginning. What made you forget this? What made you ignore us? Well, I don't know. But now you live in shades of shit. Now you are getting sick. Then he laughed at them. He laughed at them. Then those people talked among themselves. What he says is true, they said. Look at what has become of us. We were thinking only of ourselves. Our greed is responsible for our trouble. We looked down on our own relatives and gave them nothing. Look what has become of us. Then they shared their corn. Finally, they did this. Their relatives took the corn away, saying nothing. Saying nothing. Now those people were allowed to leave their homes. Then those people said, We must leave here and go somewhere else to live. This is a bad place. It stinks with signs of our stinginess and greed. It could have happened that way, Charles says almost casually. And then a bit sternly, Let's move on. We've been here long enough. During the next 2 weeks, we visit other places with Apache commemorative names, and Charles relates the stories that explain their origins and supply their cultural backing. At several of these places, as at Shades of Shit, he finds the stories threadbare and proceeds to enlarge upon them, building historical place worlds with ease and consummate skill. Each story is concerned with disruptive social acts, with everyday life gone out of control, and each concludes with a stark reminder that trouble would not have occurred if people had behaved in ways they knew they should. Each depicts the anguish of those who erred and the depth of their regret. For me, riveted and moved, the country takes on a different cast, a density of meaning, and with it, a formidable strength it did not have before. Here, there, and over there I see are places which proclaim by their presence and their names both the imminence of chaos and the preventative wisdom of moral norms. Don't make mistakes, these places seem to say. Think sensibly and do what is right, for therein goodness lies, the goodness inherent in established patterns of social order, and therein lies survival. These are my thoughts at Widow's Pause for Breath. Ista Hadan Naiole, a grassy flat with sunflowers where three Apache sisters keened for several days after learning that their husbands, with whom they had violated sexual prescriptions, had died in a raid against some Navajos. And again, at They Piled on Top of Each Other, Ilk Ajij Ede, a former gambling ground, where a man was killed and others injured in a furious brawl triggered by unfounded accusations of cheating during a high-stakes match for horses. And again, at Navajos Are Coming, Udaha Kae Kaeye, a winding draw where four Apache families avoided certain ambush, when an alert young woman heard a horse whose nicker she did not recognize. A complacent sentry, supposedly on guard, was asleep at his post, having drunk too much tuibai, literally gray water, a native beverage made from corn. The commemorative place names, accompanied by their stories, continue to accumulate, each one marking the site of some sad or tragic event from which valuable lessons can be readily drawn and taken fast to heart. And these names, too, like their more descriptive counterparts, have a poetry of their own, a song they sing, haunting and provocative, in a voice as old as Apaches on the land. Place names, such as Sa'an Ejit Eje, two old women are buried, a hill. Tu Ahie'e Nzine, they are grateful for water, a small flat close to an arroyo. Na'isho Bitsit Ie, lizards dart away in front, the eastern face of a mountain. Kola Dach Ewure, she carries her brother on her back, a steep slope. Sa'asile Sidaha, she became old sitting, a cornfield. Take Godzige, rotten field, another cornfield. Ihina Ha'itin, trail to life goes up, a butte. Chaghashe Bike'e, children's footprints, a rock in an evanescent stream. Do Bigawane, flies camp, an ephemeral spring, and many more besides. On the second day of August, while drinking coffee near a sandstone formation named Tse Itzog Des Aha, yellow rocks jut out, Charles announces that he will work with us no more. There are plants he needs to collect, medicines he must make, and he is counting on Jason to help him until the start of school. He also notes that Morley and I have yet to translate some of the tapes he made during the summer, and this, of course, will take time. It would not be wise for us, he means me, to do it in a hurry. Charles seems relieved with his decision to leave our project, glad that his time will again be his own, to do with as he chooses. Autumn is not far off. The clouds have told him that. And now is none too soon to begin to prepare for winter. He is obviously eager to get on with other things. But Charles is not finished teaching. Fingering his hat and looking at the ground, he recalls the day in May when he explained to me that Western Apache place names were created by his ancestors, that they were and are his ancestors' very own words. Now he believes, I know this to be so. He also wants me to know that our travels together were planned by him to reflect the changing conditions under which the names were conferred. Descriptive place names came first, he reminds me, bestowed at a time when his ancestors were exploring the land and deciding to make it their home. The names of clans, which are based upon descriptive place names, came later, when the land was being settled and people had gathered in the vicinity of farms. Commemorative names were awarded last, after the Apaches had made the land their own and were experiencing the rewards and also the painful problems that come with community living. Additional names, he goes on to say, have been coined in recent times, in English as well as in Apache, but these are fairly few, and of relatively minor consequence. The point Charles wishes to make is one he made before, that whenever one uses a place name, even unthinkingly, one is quoting ancestral speech, and that is not only good, but something to take seriously. It is something he says to think about. And now it is time to go. Morley looks downcast, and I am feeling sad. We will miss our days in the country with Charles. Stumbling over my words, I try to thank him for all he has done. He listens, nods, and once again takes steps to relieve an awkward moment. Jason needs to drink pop, he says brightly. Maybe Orange Crush. Morley, you need a Reese's cup. And then, adjusting his well-worn hat, Charles Henry smiles and turns to walk back to the Jeep. Place Words and Western Apache History. In 1962, the distinguished anthropologist Edward N. Spicer observed somewhat wistfully that Western Apache people, while plainly interested in their own tribal history, showed very little interest in becoming tribal historians. Curiously enough, the Western Apache are one of the most written about peoples of the Southwest, and yet they remain, in my opinion, the most poorly understood by white men. Apaches complain constantly that all the history in print misrepresents them. Yet so far, no Apache autobiographer or even a rough chronicler has emerged. Perhaps we may expect that development within the next few years. Today, more than 30 years later, one could still maintain that the Western Apaches have yet to produce a tribal historian, but only were one to judge, as Spicer did, by Anglo-American standards of what historians are and how they practice their craft. And there, of course, is the rub. For by now it should be clear that Apache standards for interpreting the past are not the same as our own, and that working Apache historians, Charles Henry among them, go about their business with different aims and procedures. It may also have been surmised that few Apache people would wish to change these procedures, much less abandon them, and that Spicer's call to adopt another approach will probably go unheeded for quite some time to come. But why? Why the resistance? What is it about established Apache practices for exploring tribal history that Apache men and women find so attractive and rewarding? And why are certain Anglo-American practices, such as crafting extended chronicles and presenting autobiographies, tangential to their interests and unsuited to their tastes? What, in short, creates the evident gulf between these two conflicting perspectives on making useful visits to the country of the past? As conceived by Apaches from Sibicu, the past is a well-worn path or trail, Intin, which was traveled first by the people's founding ancestors, and which subsequent generations of Apaches have traveled ever since. Beyond the memories of living persons, this path is no longer visible. The path has disappeared, and thus it is unavailable for direct consult and study. For this reason, the past must be constructed, which is to say, imagined, with the aid of historical materials, sometimes called footprints or tracks, bike gozaa, that have survived into the present. These materials come in various forms, including Apache place names, Apache stories and songs, and different kinds of relics found at locations throughout Apache country. The hand-cut stones surrounding the spring at Snake's Water provide a good example. Because no one knows when these phenomena came into being, locating past events in time can be accomplished only in a vague and general way. This is of little consequence, however, for what matters most to Apaches is where events occurred, not when, and what they serve to reveal about the development and character of Apache social life. In light of these priorities, temporal considerations, though certainly not irrelevant, are accorded secondary importance. For people like Charles Henry and Morley Cromwell, the country of the past, and with it Apache history, is never more than a narrated place world away. It is thus very near as the workings of their own imaginations, and can be easily brought to life at almost any time. It is history constructed in spurts, in sudden bursts of imaginative activity, and it takes the form of stories delivered in spoken Apache, the language of the ancestors and most of their modern descendants. Answering the question, what happened here, it deals in the main with single events, and because these are tied to places within Apache territory, it is pointedly local and unfailingly episodic. It is also extremely personal, consistently subjective, and therefore highly variable among those who work to produce it. For these and other reasons, it is history without authorities. All narrated place worlds, provided they seem plausible, are considered equally valid, and the idea of compiling definitive accounts is rejected out of hand as unfeasible and undesirable. Weakly empirical, thinly chronological, and rarely written down, Western Apache history, as practiced by Apaches, advances no theories, tests no hypotheses, and offers no general models. What it does instead, and likely has done for centuries, is fashion possible worlds, give them expressive shape, and present them for contemplation as images of the past that can deepen and enlarge awareness of the present. In the country of the past, as Apaches like to explore it, the placemaker is an indispensable guide, and this in a powerful sense. For the placemaker's main objective is to speak the past into being, to summon it with words and give it dramatic form, to produce experience by forging ancestral worlds in which others can participate and readily lose themselves. To this engrossing end, as Charles Henry showed repeatedly, the placemaker often speaks as a witness on the scene, describing ancestral events as they are occurring and creating in the process a vivid sense that what happened long ago, right here, on this very spot, could be happening now. Within this narrative frame, all is movement and animated talk. The ancestors come and go, voicing their thoughts and feelings, always engaged in pressing activities, naming places and clans, cultivating corn, guarding against enemies. Occasionally elated, often subdued, constantly concerned with staying alive. Leaders lead, followers follow, and most of the time, things are done correctly. But now and again, mistakes are made, serious trouble ensues, and social life is shattered. Pathos reigns, and the air is charged with suspense. What will happen next? What will the ancestors do? How will they survive? Thus, performed and dramatized, Western Apache placemaking becomes a form of narrative art, a type of historical theater in which the pastness of the past is summarily stripped away and long-elapsed events are made to unfold as if before one's eyes. It is history given largely in the active present tense. Now they are arriving. And it makes extensive use of quoted speech to enter the hearts and minds of those who it portrays. Our relatives will not harm us, they said. Now we are in for trouble, they thought. It is typically concise, tends to be closely plotted, and rarely becomes redundant. It thrives on verisimilitude. There were swarms and swarms of flies, huge swarms. And what it may lack in subtlety is more than offset by moments of intense urgency and involvement with its subjects. Look, what has become of us now? Its principal themes are the endless quest for survival, the crucial importance of community and kin, and the beneficial consequences, practical and otherwise, of adhering to moral norms. Accordingly, one of its basic aims is to instill empathy and admiration for the ancestors themselves. They came, they settled, they toiled, they endured, and to hold them up to all as worthy of emulation, except, of course, when they fail to do what is right and threatened by their actions the welfare of the group. Then they are punished or killed. By comparison, Western Apache history of the Anglo-American variety strikes many Apache people as distant and unfamiliar. Unspoken and unanimated, it lies silent and inert on the printed English page. It is history without voices to thrust it into the present. Removed from the contexts of daily social life, reading, Apaches have noticed, is an isolating activity. It also seems unconnected to daily affairs and concerns. It is history without discernible applications. Detached from the local Apache landscape, it has few spatial anchors, and when places are identified, as often they are not, their names are not their own. It is history loosely situated, geographically adrift. Obsessed with dating historical events, it packs them into tightly ordered sequences, which it then may try to explain by invoking abstract forces, mounting tribal aggression, and outbreaks of cultural disarray were two of Morley Cromwell's favorites, in which no one can quite believe. It thus becomes remote, intangible, divorced in suspect ways from the forces of human agency. Commonly qualified and sometimes hotly debated by persons who construct it, it appears to be in search of final historical truths of which Apaches believe there are very few indeed. It can therefore seem arrogant and misguided, pretending to large discoveries it could not possibly make, and it does go on and on, persistently uninformed by the views of Apache people, suggesting quite improbably that useful accounts of history can and should be fashioned without consulting those whose history it is. Add to this that it has almost nothing to say about the people's early ancestors and that recognizable place worlds are virtually non-existent, and you have a set of practices which, by Western Apache standards, rather miss the mark. Apache tribal history, as crafted by Anglo-Americans, proceeds on different assumptions, produces a different discourse, and involves a different aesthetic. Mute and unperformed, sprawling in its way over time and space alike, it strikes Apache audiences as dense, turgid, and lacking in utility. But far more important is the fact that it does not excite, it does not captivate, it does not engage and provoke a measure of wonder. As Charles Henry said once in English, summing up quite a bit, it's pretty mainly quiet. It stays far away from all our many places. Staying away from places is something that Western Apaches would not recommend. And in this pervasive conviction, they are not alone. As Vine Deloria Jr., Standing Rock Sioux, has observed, most American Indian tribes embrace spatial conceptions of history in which places and their names, and all that these may symbolize, are accorded central importance. For Indian men and women, the past lies embedded in features of the earth, in canyons and lakes, mountains and arroyos, rocks and vacant fields, which together endow their lands with multiple forms of significance that reach into their lives and shape the ways they think. Knowledge of places is therefore closely linked to knowledge of the self, to grasping one's position in the larger scheme of things, including one's own community, and to securing a confident sense of who one is as a person. With characteristic eloquence, N. Scott Momade, Kiowa, suggests that this has been so for a very long time. From the time the Indian first set foot upon this continent, he centered his life in the natural world. He is deeply invested in the earth, committed to it both in his consciousness and in his instinct. The sense of place is paramount. Only in reference to the earth can he persist in his identity. In the Western Apache case, this is certainly true. The people's sense of place, their sense of their tribal past, and their vibrant sense of themselves are inseparably intertwined. Their identity has persisted. Their ancestors saw to this, and in the country of the past, where the ancestors come alive in resonating place worlds, they do so still today. Their voices are strong and firm, and sometimes it is unclear who is quoting whom. 2. Stalking with Stories. American Indians hold their lands, places, as having the highest possible meaning, and all their statements are made with this reference point in mind. Vine Deloria Jr., God is Red. Shortly before his death in 1960, Clyde Clacone made the following observation in a course he gave at Harvard University on the history of anthropological thought. The most interesting claims people make are those they make about themselves. Cultural anthropologists should keep this in mind, especially when they are doing fieldwork. Although Clacone's comment seemed tenuously connected to the topic of his lecture, he was speaking that day on the use of statistical methods in culture and personality studies, few of his students were distracted or annoyed. We had discovered early on that some of his most provocative thoughts came in the form of brief asides delivered casually and without apology at unexpected moments. We also learned that these ostensibly offhand remarks frequently contained advice on a topic that we were eager to know more about: ethnography and ethnographic research. Rarely, however, did Clacone see fit to elaborate on his advice, and so it was only later, after some of us had become ethnographers ourselves, that we could begin to assess it properly. I think that in this instance, Clacone was right. Attending carefully to claims that people make about themselves, and then trying to grasp with some exactness what they have claimed and why, can be a perplexing and time-consuming business. But when the work goes well, when puzzling claims are seen to make principled sense, and when, as consequence of this, one is able to move closer to an understanding of who the people involved take themselves to be, it can be richly informative and highly worthwhile. Indeed, as Cluckhone implied in his textbook Mirror for Man, 1949, it is just this sort of work that makes ethnography the singularly valuable activity, and he might have added, the singularly arresting and gratifying one,